Did the Neocons Save the World from the Thucydides Trap? By Ron Unz. Published April 18, 2023, in the Unz Review. Over the last couple of decades, I've begun seeing our growing conflict with China described as an inevitable consequence of the Thucydides Trap, but hadn't been entirely sure of the source of that idea. Decades ago, I'd had a very strong interest in classical Greek history, so the reference was obvious to me. The bitter rivalry between a dominant Sparta and a rising Athens that had led to the decades-long Peloponnesian War that devastated Greece. But only recently did I discover that the term had been popularized in Destined for War, a 2017 national bestseller by Harvard's Graham Allison, which had followed his earlier 2015 Atlantic article on the same subject. The Thucydides Trap. Are the U.S. and China headed for war? In 12 of 16 past cases in which a rising power has confronted a ruling power, the result has been bloodshed. Graham Allison, The Atlantic, September 24, 2015, 3,700 words. Although I'd never read any of Allison's previous works, he'd become the founding dean of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government just a couple of years before I'd entered the college as a freshman, so I'd been quite familiar with his name for decades. His topic concerned me, so I decided to read his relatively short book as well as his original article on the same subject. Allison's entire academic career has been extremely sober and respectable, and this surely magnified the impact of his incendiary title and dramatic prediction. The front of the paperback edition was packed with a remarkable 10 pages of glowing endorsements by a long list of the West's most prestigious public figures and intellectuals, ranging from Joe Biden to Henry Kissinger to General David Petraeus, to Klaus Schwab. It seemed obvious that his message had struck a deep chord, and his national bestseller received enormous acclaim, being selected as a book of the year by the New York Times, the London Times, the Financial Times, and Amazon. So even as far back as 6 years ago, the serious possibility of an American war with China had suddenly become a very hot topic to our political and intellectual elites. Allison's reasoning was simple yet compelling. As he explained in the opening of his original 2015 article, although war between China and America might seem unlikely or even unthinkable, a broad consideration of historical analogs suggested otherwise, with the unexpected outbreak of World War I being the most obvious example. Following the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union more than three decades ago, America had emerged as the sole unchallenged global superpower. But over the last generation, the tremendous growth rate of the Chinese economy had propelled it past America's in real size, the first such transition since our own country had overtaken Britain near the end of the 19th century. China's technological progress had been equally rapid, and in our modern world, these constitute the raw elements of global power, while China had also begun bolstering its military, not previously a high priority. I'd certainly been well aware of these same trends, and several years earlier I'd published a long article of my own on the contrasting trajectories of China and America, but I'd never considered military conflict as a realistic possibility. China's rise, America's fall. Which superpower is more threatened by its extractive elites? Ron Unz, The American Conservative, April 17, 2012, 6,600 words. However, when Allison and his associates sifted the last 500 years of history to locate cases in which the rapidly growing power of a rising nation had threatened to overtake that of a dominant reigning one, they discovered that in well over half the examples, 12 out of 16, the result had been war. Some of these individual historical cases may easily be disputed, and indeed a couple of the ones provided in his 2015 article differed from those in his 2017 book. But the general pattern seemed quite clear. Even the oldest and deepest cultural and political ties hardly prevented this outcome. Prior to World War I, Britain and Germany had never previously fought a war against each other, and indeed the latter's Prussian predecessor had traditionally been Britain's staunchest continental ally. The two imperial families were also deeply interwoven, with the British monarchy having multiple German antecedents, while Queen Victoria's favorite grandchild was Kaiser Wilhelm II, and she died in his arms. The English language itself had German roots, hardly surprising since the Angles and the Saxons had originally been Germanic tribes. Yet all of these centuries of close ties counted for little compared to the simple geopolitical fact that Germany's growing industrial and military power threatened to overshadow that of its kindred nation on the other side of the Channel. By contrast, the political, cultural, and racial gulf separating America from a rising China seems immense, easily lending itself to the crudest demonization, the sort of populist demagoguery able to stoke national hatred. Not only is China's language and culture totally different than our own, but for three generations that country has been governed by a Communist Party whose official ideology totally differs from our own democratic constitutionalism. Many hundreds of thousands of Chinese troops had fought against American forces during the Korean War, inflicting most of our 36,000 combat deaths. Obviously, all of these points of past hostility had been set aside in President Richard Nixon's historic opening to China in 1972, after which our two countries had become quasi-allies against the military might of the Soviet Union during the latter stages of the Cold War. But with geopolitical realities now apparently driving us into likely confrontation, these facts could provide an easy means of resurrecting and focusing popular hostility against our rising rival power, with the confrontation over the independently ruled Chinese province of Taiwan in the South China Sea providing a natural flashpoint. According to most accounts of World War I, the formation of two rival alliances had transformed Europe into a tinderbox, eventually ignited by the spark of a Balkan assassination and resulting in a cataclysmic war that neither side had sought nor expected. And this is Allison's model for how a military clash between China and America might occur. One of his later chapters is entitled From Here to War, and he provides various scenarios of how hostile conflicting naval patrols in the South China Sea might easily result in a collision involving loss of life, prompting several rounds of face-saving escalation on both sides and eventually erupting into full-scale warfare. Allison's most famous previous work had been his landmark 1971 study of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he had later spent a number of years as an advisor in the Reagan and Clinton defense departments. So he was well-versed in the realities of such military decision-making. His concerns seem reasonable, and he described several such Chinese-American naval incidents that had narrowly been averted in the recent past. When the military forces of two large hostile powers are aggressively patrolling the same region, an eventual clash hardly seems unlikely, which political pressures might then escalate in dangerous ways. The provocative title of Allison's book should have probably included a question mark, Destined for War? But otherwise, I unfortunately found his historical and geopolitical analysis all too plausible. Allison has hardly been alone among prominent academics in thinking along these same lines. In 2001, political scientist John Mearsheimer of the University of Chicago had published The Tragedy of Great Power Politics, providing a theoretical framework for his doctrine of offensive realism, which he claimed best explained the behavior of nations. Under his conception, all great powers aspire to become hegemons, countries far more powerful than any of their regional rivals. And for hundreds of years, wars had been fought either to establish or to block such hegemony, with the Napoleonic Wars and the First and Second World Wars being obvious examples of this. Although such hegemony was regional scope, he argued that there was also a strong incentive for an established hegemon in one part of the world to block the rise of any potentially rival hegemon elsewhere. Thus, once America had achieved a hegemonic position in the Western Hemisphere, it had naturally intervened in the two world wars to prevent Germany from gaining a similar status in Europe or Japan from doing so in East Asia. According to Mearsheimer, typical strategies involved the creation and support of local balancing coalitions, alliances of other regional powers used to prevent the rise of a local hegemon. Thus, America had supported Britain and France in order to prevent Germany from gaining European hegemony in World War I, and did the same for those two powers along with the Soviets in World War II. Similarly, our country had blocked Japan's rise for East Asian hegemony by allying ourselves with China, Australia, and Britain in the Far East theater of that later conflict. The updated 2014 edition of his book included a long last chapter focused upon China, whose large and rapidly growing power seemed likely to establish it as a potential Asian hegemon. Therefore, under Mearsheimer's theoretical framework, a clash with America was almost inevitable, and our country would naturally foster an anti-China coalition of other local powers to forestall China's regional dominance. A decade earlier, he had already hotly disputed the same issue against famed geopolitical strategist Zbigniew Brzezinski in the pages of Foreign Policy, with these two leading figures of the realist school debating whether an American military conflict with China was likely to occur. Clash of the Titans. Is China more interested in money than missiles? Will the United States seek to contain China as it once contained the Soviet Union? Zbigniew Brzezinski and John Mearsheimer go head-to-head on whether these two great powers are destined to fight it out. Zbigniew Brzezinski versus John Mearsheimer, Foreign Policy, January-February 2005, 2600 words. The crucial point emphasized by both Allison and Mearsheimer is that the particular characteristics of America and China, their political systems, cultures, histories, and national leaderships, were largely irrelevant in predicting their likely military confrontation. Instead, all that matters was America's status as a reigning global power and China's as a rising one, with all those other differences merely serving as convenient means of mobilizing public support behind a conflict driven solely by considerations of power politics. This sort of framework constitutes geopolitical realism in its purest form. Although such a basis for conflict or alliance might seem alien to many Americans, it has actually been quite common in the modern era. After all, arch-Republican France was the closest military partner of Tsarist Russia's absolute monarchy in their balancing alliance against Germany prior to World War I. The liberal democracies of Britain and America later allied themselves with Stalin's Soviet Union against Germany, and diehard anti-communist Winston Churchill was a leading advocate of that policy. More recently, America joined with Maoist China to oppose the far less ideologically extreme Soviet Union because the latter was viewed as a powerful military threat to both. Political differences or similarities have often been swamped by more practical considerations in international relations. Neither Allison nor Mearsheimer makes an ironclad case that war with China is inevitable, nor do they claim to do so. But the historical evidence they present is sufficiently extensive to be quite worrisome. And as Allison sketches out, under a tense confrontational situation, relatively minor military incidents in the South China Sea could easily escalate, perhaps even eventually reaching the threshold of nuclear war. Mearsheimer's updated volume had appeared in 2014, followed by Allison's national bestseller in 2017, and the unfortunate situation they predicted has become more and more plausible every year, marked by a steady increase in the rhetoric of America's political leadership as amplified by the mainstream media. I suspect that their books and other public presentations may have fostered this trend, transforming the notion of such a global war with China from the unthinkable to the plausibly realistic. Several senior figures in the Trump administration, most notably National Security Advisor John Bolton and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, were certainly hostile towards China, a country they portrayed as our leading international adversary, and much of the Republican Party has also adopted that same rhetoric. After the Democrats regained the White House in 2020, many had expected these trends to reverse, but instead they have actually accelerated, with the Biden administration imposing unprecedented economic sanctions on China's crucial microchip industry, together with loud saber-rattling over Taiwan, and the Democrats and Republicans are now competing over which party can be tougher on China. The huge recent media flap over an errant Chinese balloon is the most extreme example of this. As Mearsheimer and Allison both emphasized, a central component of America's anti-China geopolitical strategy has been to organize a local balancing coalition to support our containment efforts, and Anglophone Australia has been a charter member of that group. We share a British colonial heritage with that country, which fought as our staunch ally in World War II, and its politics is heavily influenced by native son Rupert Murdoch's powerful right-wing media empire. So given these factors, Australia's once very friendly relations with China have rapidly shifted in this new direction, marked by episodes of intense public hostility and trade embargoes. Naively optimistic Americans might hope that any future war with China could be kept far from our shores, with our own large country protected by the width of the Pacific Ocean. But no rational Australian could feel the same way, since his country lives in that region and is dwarfed by a China 50 times larger in population, ensuring that any war would be likely to have devastating consequences. Thoughtful Australians have surely recognized these facts and grown alarmed at these dangerous international trends, so it was hardly surprising that one of the first major responses to the Allison-Mearsheimer framework came from an Australian. Kevin Rudd had served two terms as Prime Minister of his country, 2007 to 2010 and 2013, and afterwards relocated to America, where he served as president of the Asia Society based in New York City prior to being named Australia's ambassador to our country a few weeks ago. In March 2022, he published The Avoidable War, bearing the grimly accurate subtitle The Dangers of a Catastrophic Conflict Between the U.S. and Xi Jinping's China. Although I had only been very slightly familiar with his career, I decided to read his book for his insights on averting this looming global conflict. Rudd seems to possess an ideal background for the important task he has set himself, having majored in Chinese studies in college and being completely fluent in Mandarin, a language he began learning at age 18. As he explained in his introduction, he has lived and traveled extensively in both China and America, has many friends in each country, and very much hoped that they could together avert what he regarded as their unnecessary conflict. I found his book excellent, and it certainly merited the glowing praise it received from Allison himself, a personal friend of the author, as well as from Kissinger and other leading American military and academic figures. The work was published in English and obviously aimed primarily at an American audience, so it appropriately devoted the bulk of its pages to explicating China's perspective, but the American side of the conflict also received considerable coverage. Personalities may often matter little in geopolitics, but there are also some exceptions. Following the 1997 death of Deng Xiaoping, China had been run by a collective leadership, with several jostling factions and important figures usually sharing political power with its top leader. But Rudd emphasized that this situation has now drastically changed, and Chinese President Xi Jinping has successfully established his personal authority in China to an unprecedented extent, sidelining all his potential Communist Party rivals and making himself the most powerful Chinese leader since Mao. Xi also managed to remove the re-election term limits for his office, and although he is now 69, his father lived to 88, while his mother is still alive at 96, so he could still remain China's paramount leader through the 2020s and into the 2030s. Given these realities, any current analysis of Chinese goals and strategies should necessarily focus on those of President Xi, who therefore constitutes the central figure of Rudd's book. Indeed, the work seems to heavily overlap with the author's Oxford doctoral dissertation on Xi Jinping's worldview that he had also been preparing during those same years. Rudd seems uniquely qualified to provide this analysis. Prior to becoming prime minister, he had had a long career as an Australian diplomat, eventually rising to become foreign minister, and he had first met Xi more than 35 years ago when both were very junior figures. Over the years, he has spent a total of 10 hours in conversation with him on six separate occasions, including some that were quite informal. Add to this his multitude of other personal sources acquired over the decades, both Chinese and Western, and I doubt that there are many outsiders who can match his understanding of the goals of China's top leader. Therefore, we should take the author quite seriously when on a couple of occasions he described these in dramatic terms. Xi wants to secure a place for himself in Chinese party history that is at least equal to Mao and greater than Deng. Rudd presents Xi's major goals in a series of 10 chapters, representing the concentric circles of his strategic objectives, and these occupy half the book. Xi places the greatest importance upon maintaining political power and securing national unity, followed by economic development, modernizing the military, and then increasing China's influence in its neighborhood, along its Asian periphery, and eventually worldwide. I found Rudd's organizational approach helpful and his analysis quite plausible. Obviously, major nations often possess conflicting interests, and the rise of Chinese power would necessarily produce a relative decline in America's. But across all those chapters, I found few deep-seated, inherent conflicts between our two continent-scale countries. Just a few weeks ago, I had reread Zbigniew Brzezinski's influential 1997 book, The Grand Chessboard. That author had similarly laid out a set of strategies and goals intended to secure America's influence and position at the head of our global community, but his plans were hardly aimed at threatening the vital interests of our leading competitors, let alone provoking a war. I had very much taken Brzezinski's side during his 2004 debate with Mearsheimer on China, and to the extent that Rudd has correctly analyzed Xi's worldwide goals and plans, I would put those in much the same category. International rivalry, even occasionally involving sharp elbows, should not necessarily produce international conflict any more than domestic political rivalry must lead to civil war. However, nations that are seeking to provoke a conflict can usually find a means of doing so, and I think our current Taiwan flashpoint with China clearly falls into that category. For half a century, the American government had officially recognized that Taiwan was part of China, but some high-ranking American political leaders, both Democrat and Republican, have recently called the settled matter into question, thereby directly challenging China on what it regards as a core national interest. Rudd's own take on these dangerous developments was much less one-sided than mine, and he emphasized that the changes in our Taiwan policy had partly been prompted by Chinese heavy-handedness, notably the 2019 police crackdown on massive street protests in Hong Kong. The author's expertise dwarfs my own, and perhaps he was entirely correct. But there also have been widespread speculation that those protests themselves were actually orchestrated by Western intelligence services along the lines of a deliberately provocative color revolution, and Rudd might be reluctant to take a position that fell too far outside the boundaries of his elite establishment social circle. I also noticed that he was surprisingly critical of Xi for his recent crackdown on Chinese tech giants, real estate and financial services firms, and the private tutoring industry, all economic sectors near and dear to Wall Street, investors, and our reigning neoliberal establishment, although Rudd did explain that China's leader regarded these activities as often parasitical. America's approach to China has undergone a drastic shift over the last few years, under both the Trump and Biden administrations. Rudd described these changes and then provided a chapter entitled The Decade of Living Dangerously, sketching out 10 different scenarios of potential military confrontation, half of them involving armed conflict, sometimes with disastrous political consequences for one or the other of our two countries. He himself hoped that we would instead follow a policy of managed strategic competition, whose elements he outlined in his long final chapter, and this is obviously my own preference as well. All the suggestions he made were sensible ones, but I wonder whether our ruling political elites are paying much attention to his words. Although I found his work very useful, and I would highly recommend it to others, I saw little that effectively refuted the cold geopolitical logic previously presented by Allison and Mearsheimer. Rudd's book hardly dissuaded me from the concern that the world may be locked into the Thucydides trap, with the likely result being a severe global confrontation between China and America, possibly leading to war. Rudd had opened his book by discussing the tragic legacy of World War I, which together with its second round, 20 years later, destroyed so much of Europe, and I fear the analogy is a strong one. Just as the political and military leaders of 1914 severely misjudged the dangers they were confronting and were carried along to war on a tide they felt unable to resist, I think that today's situation may be much the same. The title of Mearsheimer's book rightly emphasized the word tragedy. Moreover, we are actually facing a double peril. Even if the deep historical forces propelling the world towards war were not already so strong, over the last three decades, the arrogant and often incompetent neocons have gained control of the foreign policy establishments of both our political parties. Their dangerous adventurism has entirely replaced the sober realism of a Brzezinski, who probably would have played his cards in a very different manner. Yet, oddly enough, under fortuitous circumstances, the vector sum of different threats may sometimes cancel out rather than reinforce each other, and this might be one of those rare occasions. It is possible that the deep ideological flaws of the neocons running American foreign policy may actually help to avert a global clash between America and China on non-ideological grounds that have been predicted by those different authors. Allison and Mearsheimer focused on historical trends over centuries, and their books were published within the last decade, while Rudd's book was released only a year ago. Under normal circumstances, these works could hardly be considered dated. But Russia's Ukraine war began in late February 2022, and the geopolitical consequences over the last year have been enormous, even transformational. When Mearsheimer had written his long final chapter in 2014, he had naturally envisioned Russia as a central element of the balancing coalition that America would construct against the Chinese, together with India and Japan, as well as smaller powers such as South Korea and Vietnam. Any rational American geopolitical strategist seeking to contain a rising China would have taken that approach. But the neocons running the foreign policy of the Obama administration were remarkably arrogant rather than rational, and that same year they orchestrated an anti-Russian coup in Ukraine, followed by the loss of Crimea and ongoing fighting in the Donbas, all of which permanently poisoned Russian relations. Not long afterward, Mearsheimer gave his prophetic talk on the looming future risks of a NATO-Russia conflict in Ukraine, a presentation that over the last year has been viewed some 29 million times on YouTube, perhaps more than any academic lecture in the history of the Internet. Thus, by the time Allison published his 2017 book, any possibility of an American-Russian alliance against China had evaporated, and Russia scarcely featured in his discussion. These trends continued, and a year ago, Rudd's book already characterized China and Russia as strategic partners, mentioning that Xi had described Russian President Vladimir Putin as his best friend, and that the two countries regularly collaborated on a variety of different political, military, and economic issues. But Russia still remained a minor factor in Rudd's analysis, with its role discussed in just a couple of pages together with scattered references elsewhere in his text. The outbreak of the Russia-Ukraine war completely changed everything, as did the unprecedented wave of resulting Western sanctions targeting Russia and the massive amount of financial and military aid provided to Ukraine, already totaling $120 billion, a sum far larger than the annual entire Russian defense budget. Over the last year, American-led NATO has been fighting a proxy war against Russia on Russia's own border, a war that many American political leaders have declared can only end with Russia's defeat and the death or overthrow of Putin. The Hague in Europe has already issued an arrest warrant against the Russian president for alleged war crimes. Just prior to the beginning of the Ukraine war, Xi had held his 39th personal meeting with Putin and had declared that China's partnership with Russia had no limits. The subsequent all-out Western assault on Russia has inevitably produced a tight alliance between those two huge countries. China's industrial strength is enormous, with its real productive economy already larger than the combined total for America, the European Union, and Japan. But add to that the enormous energy supplies and other natural resources of its remarkably complementary Russian neighbor, and the two together probably outweigh the power of America and its allies. Last October, I described some of the developments that had subsequently unfolded. At the start of the war, most observers believed that the unprecedented sanctions imposed by America and its NATO allies would deal a crippling blow to the Russian economy. Instead, Russia has escaped any serious damage, while the loss of cheap Russian energy has devastated the European economies and severely hurt our own, resulting in the highest inflation rates in 40 years. The Russian ruble was expected to collapse, but it is now stronger than it was before. Germany is the industrial engine of Europe, and the sanctions imposed on Russia were so self-destructive that popular protests began demanding that they be lifted and the Nord Stream energy pipelines reopened. To forestall any such potential defection, those Russian-German pipelines were suddenly attacked and destroyed, almost certainly with the approval and involvement of the U.S. government. America is not legally at war with Russia, let alone Germany, so this probably represented the greatest peacetime destruction of civilian infrastructure in the history of the world, inflicting enormous, lasting damage upon our European allies. Our total dominance over the global media has so far prevented most ordinary Europeans or Americans from recognizing what transpired, But as the energy crisis worsens and the truth gradually begins to emerge, NATO might have a hard time surviving. As I discussed in a recent article, America may have squandered three generations of European friendship by destroying those vital pipelines. American Pravda, of Pipelines and Plagues. Ron Unz, The Unz Review, October 3, 2022, 3,900 words. Meanwhile, many years of arrogant and oppressive American behavior towards so many other major countries has produced a powerful backlash of support for Russia. According to news reports, the Iranians have provided the Russians with large numbers of their advanced drones, which have effectively been deployed against the Ukrainians. Since World War II, our alliance with Saudi Arabia has been a linchpin of our Middle Eastern policy, but the Saudis have now repeatedly sided with the Russians on oil production issues, completely ignoring America's demands despite threats of retaliation from Congress. Turkey has NATO's largest military, but it is closely cooperating with Russia on national gas shipments. India has also moved closer to Russia on crucial issues, ignoring the sanctions we have imposed on Russian oil. Except for our political vassal states, most major powers seem to be lining up on Russia's side. Since World War II, one of the central pillars of global American dominance has been the status of the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency and our associated control over the international banking system. Until recently, we have always presented our role as neutral and administrative, but we have increasingly begun weaponizing that power, using our position to punish the states we disliked, and this is naturally forcing other countries to seek alternatives. Perhaps the world could tolerate our freezing the financial assets of relatively small countries, such as Venezuela or Afghanistan, but our seizure of Russia's $300 billion in foreign reserves obviously tipped the balance, and major countries are increasingly seeking to shift their transactions away from the dollar and the banking system that we control. Although the economic decline of the EU has caused a corresponding fall in the euro and has driven up the dollar by default, the longer-term prospects for our continued currency hegemony hardly seem good. And given our horrendous budgets and trade deficits, a flight from the dollar might easily collapse the U.S. economy. Soon after the outbreak of the Ukraine war, the eminent historian Alfred McCoy argued that we were witnessing the geopolitical birth of a new world order, one built around a Russia-China alliance that would dominate the European landmass. His discussion with Amy Goodman has been viewed nearly 2 million times. In a foreign policy article last month, Allison certainly recognized the momentous importance of these new developments. As he suggested in his closing paragraphs, they drastically changed the geopolitical landscape he had previously assumed in his 2017 bestseller. An elementary proposition in International Relations 101 states, "The enemy of my enemy is my friend." By confronting both China and Russia simultaneously, the United States has helped create what former U.S. National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski called an alliance of the aggrieved. This has allowed Xi to reverse Washington's successful trilateral diplomacy of the 1970s that widened the gap between China and the United States' primary enemy, the Soviet Union, in ways that contributed significantly to the U.S. victory in the Cold War. Today, China and Russia are, in Xi's words, closer than allies. Since Xi and Putin are not just the current presidents of their two nations, but leaders whose tenures effectively have no expiration dates, the United States will have to understand that it is confronting the most consequential undeclared alliance in the world. Xi and Putin have the most consequential undeclared alliance in the world. It's become more important than Washington's official alliances today. Graham Allison, Foreign Policy, March 23, 2023, 1,300 words. Furthermore, as I discussed a couple of weeks ago, these trends have continued apace. Last Wednesday, the Wall Street Journal reported that Saudi Arabia was joining China's Shanghai Cooperative Organization, a decision that came just a few weeks after the announcement that it had reestablished diplomatic relations with archenemy Iran following negotiation held in Beijing under Chinese auspices. For three generations, the oil-rich kingdom had been America's most important Arab ally, and the lead sentence of the journal article emphasized that this dramatic development reflected our waning influence in the Middle East. That same day, Brazil declared that it was abandoning the use of dollars in its transactions with China, its largest trading partner, following an earlier statement that its president planned to meet with China's leader in support of that country's efforts to end the Russia-Ukraine war, a diplomatic initiative strongly opposed by our own government. Geopolitical dominoes seem to be rapidly falling, taking down American influence with them. Given our country's horrendous budget and trade deficits, America's continued standard of living is heavily dependent upon the international use of the dollar, especially for oil sales. So these are extremely threatening developments. For decades, we have freely exchanged our government script for goods and commodities from around the world, and if that becomes much more difficult, our global situation may grow dire. During the 1956 Suez Crisis, the threatened collapse of the British pound marked the end of Britain's influence on the global stage, and America may be rapidly approaching its own Suez moment. I summarized the situation by harshly suggesting that the neocons had played a game of fool's mate on the geopolitical chessboard. Playing fool's mate on the grand Eurasian chessboard. Ron Unz, The Unz Review, April 3, 2023, 3,000 words. These geopolitical trends have further accelerated in the 2 weeks since then, with French President Emmanuel Macron traveling to Beijing and declaring that Europeans must not remain just America's followers and get caught up in crises that are not ours. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador has challenged the leadership of the United States and asked for support from China. Despite American opposition, leading German companies are strengthening their ties with China, and the Brazilian government is doing the same, with a long piece in yesterday's Asia Times summarizing a week of triumphs for Beijing. The Saudis struck another blow against America by meeting to reestablish relations with Hamas, a Palestinian organization officially classified by the U.S. as terrorists. On Saturday, a short column by Douglas McKinnon, a longtime Republican figure who had served in the Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations, summarized some of these geopolitical trends and warned that the loss of confidence in America might soon face our country with the geopolitical equivalent of a worldwide bank run. Is there a worldwide run on the Bank of the United States of America? Douglas McKinnon, The Hill, April 15, 2023, 900 words. The reality is that over the last year, the neocon-orchestrated war against Russia has collapsed any American hopes of forming a strong anti-China coalition. For generations, India's had a troubled relationship with China, and just a couple of years ago, a bitter border skirmish had prompted a national ban on TikTok. But India and Russia had been strong allies throughout the Cold War, and most of India's military equipment is still Russian, while it has also benefited from a very lucrative trade in refining and selling sanctioned Russian oil. So India has now clearly moved towards the Russia-China bloc. In recent years, China has become the largest market for Saudi oil, while Russia is the other leading member of the crucial OPEC Plus cartel. With both those countries joined together in a tight embrace, a Saudi shift from its long-standing American alliance was hardly so surprising, but it still generated shockwaves. Japan's energy needs have led it to begin importing Russian oil despite the Western campaign of sanctions. So even our strongest ally in the Far East may be starting to reconsider its options. In his 2014 analysis, Mearsheimer logically presented Russia, India, and Japan as the three most important members of the balancing coalition that America would create against China. But we now have lost two or possibly all three of those countries. The First World War lasted so long and cost so many millions of lives because the two contending coalitions were evenly matched, with the rising power of Germany so immensely strong that an alliance of the next three European powers, Britain, Russia, and France, could barely fight it to a draw over 4 years, and only American intervention finally turned the tide at the end. As Neil Ferguson cogently argued in The Pity of War, a swift German victory would have essentially resulted in the creation of the EU a century earlier and with negligible bloodshed. But if the British government of the time had been so mad as to deliberately provoke a conflict with Russia on the eve of that war, thereby driving the Tsar into the arms of his German cousin, the resulting realignment would have ensured a quick victory for the Kaiser, or more likely, a German-led coalition too strong to even be opposed. As envisioned by Mearsheimer, an America allied with Russia, India, Japan, and the NATO countries would have constituted a better-than-even global match for China, thereby allowing a highly aggressive American policy in the South China Sea. But neocon blunders have now produced an entirely different coalition of forces, one so unfavorable to our own country that any armed conflict has become much less likely. In his book, Allison considered a long list of geopolitical transitions over the last 500 years, and one of the few that avoided any bloodshed occurred when American power surpassed that of Britain early in the 20th century. As he tells the story, by the time the British government considered challenging American dominance in the Western Hemisphere, our country had already grown too powerful to resist, and their military leaders vetoed the idea. Lord Salisbury, the British Prime Minister, later wistfully reflected that if his country had intervened in the Civil War decades earlier and thereby split the U.S. into rival hostile nations, matters might have later played out very differently. In a similar manner, I think the developments of the last year have fostered the growth of a China-aligned global coalition far too powerful for America to directly confront, with even our subservient military leaders probably recognizing that reality. This ongoing global transition is as much economic as political, with the reigning neoliberal international institutions such as the IMF and the World Bank now facing a severe financial challenge from their newly established counterparts aligned with China. Economists Radhika Desai and Michael Hudson recently discussed these important developments, with some of their most crucial points highlighted on the Moon of Alabama blog site. The momentous nature of this shift in world power has become obvious to many national leaders, if perhaps not yet to our own. Xi met Putin for important talks at their Moscow summit last month, and as he was departing, his remarks were recorded on video. "Right now there are changes, the likes of which we haven't seen for 100 years, and we are the ones driving these changes together," Xi told Putin as he stood in the door of the Kremlin to bid him farewell. The Russian president responded, "I agree."